and welcome to this 12th edition of the Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. Today you'll hear an interview between Jonathan Pelto and Fairfield University professor Yohuru Williams. Then Jonathan Pelto joins me in the studio for an update on what's happening at the state legislature regarding education and also what's happening with the possible reauthorization of No Child Left Behind at the federal level. So first, let's begin with the discussion between Jonathan Pelto and Fairfield University professor Yohuru Williams.
We're particularly honored today to have one of the most important voices in the country around education issues in defense of public education and revealing the truth about corporate education reform movement, Dr. Yohuru Williams, who is a professor of history at Fairfield University and the associate vice president of academic affairs at Fairfield University. Dr. Williams is a historian, professor, education activist, author of both a number of books, academic books, as well as a regular writer for Huffington Post, where he writes a series of profound and provocative commentary pieces. In addition, he is very active in the effort to organize teachers across the country in speaking up for teachers, the teaching profession, and most importantly for the students and parents that need stronger advocacy at the state and federal level. So, Dr. Williams, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, John.
Most of our listeners, although we do have listeners online in other parts of the country and world, most of our listeners are here in Connecticut. And maybe you could just give a little bit of background about yourself and how you ended up teaching and working at Fairfield University.
I was actually born and raised in Bridgeport, Connecticut, had the good fortune as a young person to grow up in an environment where, fortunately, even though Bridgeport had its challenges in terms of deindustrialization and some economic woes, there was great support for the arts in public education, a great support for the arts even outside in terms of community centers like the Cultural Arts Center, where my dad worked when I was a kid, and I had an opportunity to work with young people there. And being young myself, to be exposed to art and music, dance, drama, and supplemental instruction. And we also had reading and writing programs that ran regularly there. So I grew up as someone, and my mom was a teacher, so I was someone who grew up very much appreciative of the importance of public education as the nucleus of communities, because it wasn't just what happened in the schools or even just what happened at the Cultural Arts Center. It was the fact that the centerpiece of most of what we did as a community happened in those instructional spaces and happened involving teachers and both in the arts and literature and in history in community centers and in those spaces where people lived. And I thought that was very important. I left Bridgeport to go off to college and taught for many years in Washington, D.C. in high school, and then went to Delaware State University, where I was director of social studies education, and really got an up-close and personal look at the way that schools were run. And that was slightly before the beginning of the kind of corporate education reform assault on public education, although it was occurring in pockets. It certainly hadn't reached the crescendo where it is now, but in that time, I had the good fortune, again, to work with some phenomenal teachers, to see some incredible things that were going on in rural school districts, and again, just to have this idea reaffirmed of the importance of public education and the idea of schools as the nucleus of communities. And so when all of these things began to percolate over the edge in 2005, 2006, and we were looking at assaults on public education in Chicago and in Houston and in Philadelphia and other places, it just seemed natural that there needed to be a response and that people had to step up and to talk about the good things that were happening in our schools and to advocate and fight for our schools and to remind folks that, again, you're not just talking about cutting education, you're actually talking about stripping and hurting communities and the children that those schools serve.
And so as you look out over the horizon, both with your own personal experiences as a teacher and an educator and an academic, but also as an activist, how would you define or describe what's happening across the country and here in Connecticut? And if we look at it, the situation as of 2015, where's the pendulum and who's winning the battle?
It's a difficult question, John, but for me what it comes down to is, if I had to pick one word, it would be undemocratic. And I say that because if we look at the situation in Philadelphia, if we look at what happened in Bridgeport, if we look at what's happening in New Haven right now, efforts to undermine the ability of communities to select popularly elected school boards is fundamentally against the very essence of American democracy. The situation in Bridgeport, where you had efforts to install Paul Vallis and his efforts to basically run roughshod over the popularly elected school board, even discussions of disbanding the school board. You know, these are things that as Americans we should be deeply concerned about, because although the core issues are issues that involve education, at the same time they involve the very essence of our democratic structures and our institutions. And a lot of times you get people in the community, everyday, ordinary people, who drink the Kool-Aid, so to speak, who buy the rhetoric coming from the ed reformers about failing school districts without looking at any of the data or evidence. You get folks who are willing to believe that greater accountability for teachers is the real issue without really examining the deep issues of poverty. I mentioned, for example, the deindustrialization that took place in the city of Bridgeport and the fact that we were an economic depressed city with a very low tax base, high taxes, and yet a large number of young people with special needs who were in the public schools. That required a financial commitment on the part of politicians, on the part of legislators, not this rhetoric about the failure of schools and trying to undermine the ability of teachers and administrators to meet the needs of the students that they are had to service as a result. So for me, again, I think the cornerstone, a lot of this is just an emphasis on American democracy and democratic practice and our greater concerns in addition to our children, in addition to ensuring that we're not going to do irreparable harm by imposing things like high-stakes testing in place of inquiry-based learning, is our very concern for democracy and democratic practice. And the fact that, as we've seen in Philadelphia, as we've seen in Chicago, and certainly as we've seen here in Connecticut, this may be the advance guard of the stripping of other rights that are fundamental to our ability as Americans to voice our concerns and to register our voices and have a say in the way that our governments are structured at the state, local, and national level.
If we sort of rise up to the 40,000-foot level, you've written and talked a lot about the issues of the Common Core and the Common Core standardized testing as both moving us away, moving the country, moving public education away from its roots and from its calling. Can you describe, as both somebody who has been in the classroom but also has spent a significant amount of time studying these issues, what, for those who don't know enough about the Common Core or the Common Core testing, the high-stakes testing, as you mentioned it, what are the serious threats and the downsides of that?
I'd say there are three. I'd say the first one is that what Common Core does is attempts to substitute a national curriculum, one that is not reflective of the reality of education where you have students at different levels in classrooms. We have ESL, special needs students, special education students, students who require greater interaction with teachers and paras. And so what Common Core does is assumes or claims to create a level playing field when in fact it doesn't take into account the fact that differentiated instruction has always been the nucleus and cornerstone of good teaching, and that in classrooms, teachers need the flexibility to be able to offer a range of interventions that allow students to be exposed to information and ultimately to use that information in a way that will uplift themselves and make them productive citizens and help to acclimate them to not only our democratic processes, but also just life and communities. Sometimes people fail to see that because they just view this as, oh, well, this creates kind of a level playing field and everyone's equal and everyone will be learning the same things. But the problem with that, John, historically has been, and this is true in a state like Connecticut, the curriculum itself should also be reflective of the communities that it serves. And that was always a function not only of the school board, but also educators who got together and said, look, if you live in the state of Connecticut, what are some things that are absolutely essential about the state of Connecticut that you need to know in order to be a productive citizen here, in order to know something about the history, the politics, the culture of the people that live in the state? So you would anticipate, for example, that you'd have courses in Connecticut history, that you privilege Connecticut's political structure. In Common Core, with its emphasis on kind of this national curriculum, robs educators of the opportunity to really delve into those areas, because in its emphasis on the standard canon and accepted canon, and that in conjunction with this emphasis on STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics courses, there's very little time for teachers to engage students in those things that are of a local nature that are equally important to their learning. If the emphasis, for example, is on making students better readers or making them better writers, the content itself is significant in the sense that it's going to expose them to larger issues about society and how to get along in society. But in some sense, some of that content should also be local, should also be relative to their experience. And that brings me to the second piece. the fact that really what we're talking about is bad instruction, in the sense that the idea that a curriculum could solve issues that face ESL students, for example, and that deny teachers the critical role they play as mentors. We talk about differentiated instruction and all the time that teachers spent talking about the importance of that, but there's some other things that Common Core and STEM don't take into account. For example, small class sizes. The fact that because students are different and at different developmental stages, it's important for teachers to have the flexibility to work with students where they are. And what that really requires are small class sizes and a flexibility that allows teachers to really meet those students where they are. One of the problems with high-stakes testing, one of the problems with holding teachers accountable by virtue of students' test scores, is that, again, it doesn't take into account that that's a long process. It's a process that really begins with this interaction between teachers and students, and it emphasizes the humanistic nature of teaching as an enterprise. Test scores themselves are a diagnostic. They're not the end that we seek. They're simply a way that we can evaluate how far students come. To make students' lives dependent on how well they score on a test and to hold teachers accountable to how well those students do on tests perverts the whole idea of education, going back to its roots. I think the third problem with Common Core in particular is the rhetoric, and to be quite honest about it, John, the questions that people have about its origins. There's been a lot said about this being the product of teachers working with legislators, and that's not true. There's been a lot of rhetoric about this being parent-driven. That's not true. Really what's driving this is a desire by a corporation such as Pearson Company and others who see tremendous opportunity and tremendous profits to be made in public schools by virtue of the adoption of high-stakes tests for which they provide the testing and the equipment, the purchase of iPads, for example, for students to use to take these tests. And it goes along with this idea that you can cut costs in schools and yet still create tremendous profits for corporations that seek to gain from education. The idea, for example, that you don't need highly qualified teachers. If all the content is being delivered on these electronic devices, then all you need are kind of stand-ins, which is the argument behind things like Teach for America, where you're forcing veteran teachers out of the classroom and replacing them with people who are just out of university, who have no teaching experience. But again, the argument there is that, well, you don't really need veteran teachers. You don't need, this is a specialized profession. Anybody can teach, especially when they're supported by these electronic devices, testing packets, so on and so forth, that are going to do all the work of teaching. That, again, perverts the very idea and the very foundations and basis of education. Again, it's a humanistic enterprise, and one that privileges students where they are and the ability of teachers to have the flexibility to reach those students no matter what the cost.
As we've talked some on previous shows here, and both you and I have written about this concept of somehow personalized learning as some new idea that these companies will come along and say, look, if we just put a computer in front of every child and we have the right software, it will be personalized learning, as opposed to the notion that we've had personalized learning. It's called a talented and dedicated and caring teacher in the classroom that deals with the different things that children bring, some of which, as we know, I mean, when it comes to standardized test scores, those scores are driven primarily by poverty, language barriers, and special education needs or disabilities that students bring in, and emotional and behavioral issues. And no computer is going to be able to deal with that in the way that a qualified, dedicated, properly trained teacher would be able to. And you said this notion of somehow these standards were going to, you know, solve the problem. And of course, here in Connecticut, we've had standards. They were standards that were developed with very strong teacher involvement. If nothing wrong with improving standards, there was a process for doing that. I'm not sure that the Common Core standards really are improved, other than the fact that they're demanding of students that they be approximately 2 grade levels ahead of where they are now, which is certainly a goal that we could have chosen to implement over the next 10 or 15 years. But to then take those quote-unquote standards and say that they need to be the same in Connecticut as they are in Louisiana not only violates the egalitarian society in which we live, but is just counter to the notion that diversity is a strength and that we want to promote and reward and keep diversity as part of our society. one of the issues that had come up in Bridgeport. You mentioned Paul Vallis, and of course, part of this is simply an opportunity for companies to make money. Paul Vallis signed a 5-year, $10 million contract to buy all new textbooks that would be Common Core aligned. The textbooks came up front, but the costs were spread out over the next 5 years. He left after 2 years, leaving this huge debt for buying these textbooks, many of which were not particularly useful. One of the anecdotal stories was that Bridgeport had appropriately moved away from 12th grade English literature as the standard read Chaucer, read Shakespeare, and somehow that will prepare you for the world, and had really developed an innovative program around reading African literature, Latin American literature, South American literature. And Vallis bought books that had none of those materials and instead went back to the notion that if every 12th grader just learned Shakespeare, they would somehow be more college or career ready. So I think we've seen in Connecticut, as you said, the real damage to both policy, to our schools, and the tremendous waste of money that goes along with the corporate education industry.
I couldn't agree with you more, John, and I think therein lies the problem. In a city like Bridgeport, which has been financially strapped, where you have a person come in, you know, first of all, the analysis is that the schools in Bridgeport are somehow broken, but there's no explanation from Paul Vallis or politicians, you know, Governor Malloy, Mayor Finch, no explanation as to what that means when you say the schools are broken. As a product of first public education, I ultimately went to private school, but I started out in the public schools, and again, my parents were both active in public schools, and all my friends, of course, coming out of Bridgeport, I can't say anecdotally that I saw the schools as being broken. I saw challenges. I think any teacher will tell you there are challenges. Any administrator will tell you that there are challenges. But most of those are driven by poverty and a lack of resources. And those who are honest in their analysis about the problems that face public school acknowledge that and say, the real issue is, have we really devoted and committed the resources necessary to tackling those problems in the 21st century? The response can't be what we're seeing now, with Common Core, with the emphasis on high-stakes testing, with this craziness of charter schools, which is another problem, cherry-picking students, putting them in these elite charter schools, and then claiming that you've turned the district around by essentially separating the best students from the average students and holding the public schools accountable and closing schools because you claim that, you know, they're not performing at a level that's arbitrary at best. And also, again, is not reflective of the bait and switch that's taking place with regard to how charter schools operate and who holds them accountable. We saw here in Connecticut a cheating scandal occasioned by charter schools that, again, aren't accountable to communities but are accountable to board of directors that function like corporations that, you know, again, are things that we don't want to associate in a democracy with public education and the way that our communities run. I think the other really important issue that you raised with regard to Paul Vallis is that when the opportunity presented itself for him to leave, he did so with no clear succession plan. He left the city of Bridgeport in shambles. And we've seen this again across the country with other ed reformers who come in with this kind of prefab package of the answer to the problems here are charter schools and Common Core, so on and so forth. And what we see is that in the wake of their departure, school districts that are far worse off than they were when they came, and then robbed of the rhetoric of the agents of those so-called reforms, the newspapers and the media and our blogging community has been able to expose the falsification and the cheating and the financial mismanagement that has really been a big part of what's happened with a lot of these schools. Again, it's difficult for me now, as you and I speak, students in Newark, New Jersey have taken over Cammie Anderson's office in that city. And those students are saying what people in the edublogger community, what education activists have been saying for several years now, which is that the students themselves are those who are going to suffer most as a result of these so-called reforms. And now that we see students from Denver to Newark, New Jersey, to Los Angeles, standing up to Philadelphia, standing up and saying this is the problem, we hope that politicians will finally take note. I thought a few years ago, when all those things were happening in Bridgeport with Paul Vallis, again, that the students in the city of Bridgeport were those who were hurt the most dramatically, and their voices were not heard.
And as you say, this notion that the corporate education reform industry will only attend to the truths that they perceive as valuable to their mission of disruption and creating financial opportunities for their companies as opposed to the whole truth and nothing but the truth. I mean, it strikes me as somebody from Connecticut who was a policymaker in Connecticut and now an activist in Connecticut that you never hear the corporate education reform people admit to the fact that Connecticut's education system as a whole is hardly failing, that our students do much better because in part that test scores are driven, as we said, by poverty and language barriers and whether special education needs are being met. But when you rank order, as opposed as I am to the notion of high-stakes testing and the value of standardized testing, when you rank order Connecticut, what you find is our lowest cohort of students, English language learners, do as well or better than the average students in Louisiana. So the last thing that we'd want to do is to do what Louisiana is doing. We have an achievement gap, and the corporate education reform people like to say we have a big achievement gap. We do, because of course we have tremendous wealth, tremendous poverty in Connecticut, and that poverty then, because of those factors, produce lower test scores because the students are dealing with far greater challenges. You always hear the corporate education reform people say we have the large achievement gap, and yet they never, ever talk about the need to address resources to help students overcome poverty. They never address the need for stronger English language learning programs. And they're surprisingly silent when it comes to providing even special education students with the required, mandated, and appropriate services that those children deserve. So as you point out, it really is them trying to define a world in which it will benefit their short-term and particularly financial interests. One of the reasons that I read every commentary piece that you write, and we will later give people the links to find you, but certainly the Huffington Post is a good place to start, is, put it mildly, you're a truth teller, and I'd use the term provocative, and I meant that as a compliment, because you really talk about things that, quite frankly, most people don't want to talk about. Two of your recent articles that I read, one was using the words of Martin Luther King, but the real Martin Luther King, not the glossed over Martin Luther King that has been created by a modern PR campaign. And perhaps even more importantly, the words of Malcolm X as they apply to this whole corporate education movement and high-stakes testing. And I was wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about your thinking behind those two. Hopefully people will go and read them, because I think that they will have a much better understanding than they could ever otherwise have. And by reading those, they'll get that understanding. But maybe you could talk a little bit about your thoughts behind those two articles.
You know, John, one of the most pernicious element of the education reformers, and I even hate to privilege them by calling them reformers, but the corporate interests that are behind corporate education reform, one of the most pernicious things they do is try to appropriate the history and legacy of the civil rights movement to support their agenda. And we've seen everyone from Secretary of Education Arne Duncan to Stephon Pryor here in Connecticut to Michelle Rhee trying to use the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King and the civil rights movement to support the legacy of that movement, to support their agenda, and invoking the names of people like the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King to support corporate education reform, when in fact the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King never would have supported corporate education reform. In fact, he would have recognized most of that agenda as being part and parcel of policies that are more divisive and harmful, not only to persons of color, but the larger society. King himself privileged this concept of a beloved community, and the idea that the best opportunity that we had to overcome those issues that divided us was through education. But it had to be education that moved beyond the narrow individualistic confines of what skills I need in order to get a job and be employed. And it had to be an idea, a concept of education that said, what do I need to do and what will empower me to make my community better, that will allow me to be of service to others. Those aren't lofty goals, and particularly in the 21st century, when we look around in Connecticut, when we recognize that the economic landscape has shifted, we want to train young people who are more in line with Dr. King's vision and who recognize that education is more than just about getting a job. That's important, but it's also about understanding the ways in which young people can create jobs, create opportunities, rethink the dimensions of our community, use knowledge in the interest of public service. And again, part of the reason that I wrote that is that I got tired of hearing people talk about corporate education reform and ed reform as the great civil rights issue of our time in a way that was not only ahistorical, but quite frankly criminal in the way that they framed the Reverend Dr. King's words in ways, and again, to support ideas that he never would have supported. Dr. King, for example, is a staunch critic of what is basically the playbook for charter schools today, and that is the idea that if you don't like the public schools, the best way to promote segregation is to create things that allow you to strip resources from those schools, to come up with things that allow you to create accountability issues, like this whole thing about teacher accountability, when in fact it's driven by other factors, and to claim that you're doing that in the name of justice and for black and brown children, when in fact the evidence points clearly to the fact that that is not what's driving that bus, and in fact you're hurting the very children that you claim to help. Malcolm is interesting, and you know, I wrote that piece in particular because even though the ed reformers have not used Malcolm in the same way that they've attempted to use Martin Luther King, in many ways, Malcolm X's early story and encounters with education point to the problem with high-stakes testing. There's a wonderful segment of the autobiography where Malcolm talks about finding himself in an all-white school, and he has a teacher who is very much supportive of him. And Malcolm goes to see the teacher and communicates to him that he'd like to one day become a lawyer. And the teacher, recognizing the confines of segregation, shares with Malcolm that that's an impossible dream, that in fact, because of racial segregation, he should consider working with his hands. And I kind of looked at that and said, you know, the interesting thing about that is, in a way, with high-stakes testing today, the teacher had encouraged Malcolm. He'd recognized his talent in him, and yet he was forced by the dictates of segregation to say, but these things are going to be closed to you. High-stakes testing in a lot of ways does the same thing to young people today. Teachers who may see a diamond in the rough, teachers who may recognize that despite social disabilities or ESL issues, a student that's tremendously bright who has low test scores will be forever limited by those test scores. That, again, is not the function of education. It has produced some of the greatest injustices in our country, and I think Malcolm's story is part and parcel of that and a cautionary tale about what happens to a dream deferred. Malcolm X, many years later, would talk about the importance of that moment in his life and the fact that that actually formatted much of that turn. Where does Malcolm go from there? Into a life of crime, into a life of hustling, because the pathways to success through education have been so forcefully closed in his face by something that was arbitrary, the color of his skin. The same could be said for testing, and I fear what will happen to a generation of young people whose hopes and dreams will be dashed simply because of a test score. The final piece of that, quite frankly, John, is that, you know, it's great to be able to write in HuffPost and see things at the 40,000 feet level, but it's really the work of people like yourself and your blog here in Connecticut, Wait What, which quite frankly should be the Bible for anybody concerned with the issue of corporate education reform here in Connecticut. I read it literally religiously, something that I refer to. But you do the real deep dive. And, you know, we have these two multiple audiences, people who have to get it at the 40,000 feet and understand kind of the larger issues and the rhetoric. But then the real issues, the real numbers, the real nuts and bolts of what's happening in communities across the state, and the fact that so many people seem, and I hate to use this, but it's a powerful analogy when connected to Dr. King, asleep and not really aware of the significance of this fight and how it impacts their children, their community, and how it will impact collectively our future, not only in the state, but for the nation as a whole.
Thank you for the compliment, but it is absolutely true. This business of people being asleep, and it's as much a problem with teachers, administrators, parents, the general public. You look, and other states seem to be doing better than Connecticut when it comes to these issues and rising up. New York, certainly, you see a letter that condemns the high-stakes testing, the standardized Common Core standardized testing, signed by, I think, last count, 2,000 principals across the state of New York, school principals. Here we have one or two superintendents and virtually nobody else who has spoken out against this system. And it's not as if it's hidden, other than hidden in plain sight. When Arne Duncan, the Secretary of Education, a Democrat, appointed by a Democrat, Barack Obama's Secretary of Education, says that the whole purpose of this is to be able to look a second grader in the eye and tell her whether she's on track to go to college and have a successful career, makes it cringe whether, as a parent, whether it's an urban parent, a suburban parent, a poor or more wealthy, that somehow is the definition of success. I know as a parent, I would not have thought either of my second graders were going much of anywhere at that point, but both are doing quite well, and that life, in fact, is much more than going to college, although in my case, coming from a suburban community, both will certainly be going to college, but it's about giving people the knowledge and skills in order to survive and prosper and live to the fullest in a very complex society of which a college education or job is only one small aspect of the challenges that they'll face. And I pick on Arne Duncan just because he's such a character and a caricature of their movement, but not only saying to a second grader, you know, we want to be able to tell you whether you're on track, but then when they rolled out these false Common Core tests and suburban kids did not do well, just like urban kids did not do well, he had the audacity of saying, you know, the complaints are coming from white suburban moms who are finding out for the first time that their children aren't as smart as they thought they were. And of course, that kind of rhetoric, that kind of hatred, that kind of discrimination should not even be allowed in the public discourse, protected perhaps by the First Amendment, but not part of the public policy discourse. And yet here they are not only driving the bus, but driving it off the cliff.
I couldn't agree more. And I think, you know, it's interesting when you say it shouldn't be allowed in the public policy discourse. And I agree with you. I just add one thing to that, which is that it's disturbing to me that you have people like Steph Pryor, like Arne Duncan, like Michelle Reed, John King, I mean, this is Cami Anderson, collection of individuals who, when you look at their credentials, are highly educated, who claim to care so deeply for children, and yet are perfectly willing to destroy our public schools. The foundation of American democracy has been in education. And it's a formidable task to go against people who are so well-funded and to try to speak truth to power against interests that are so deeply entrenched. And yet at the same time, as you indicate, and this is why I was so encouraged by what's happening in Newark with those students, but we need parents to step into this too. We really have to rethink our resistance to this because the very nature of our democratic practice is at stake. You can't say it any more directly than that. It's interesting with Barack Obama, the appointment of Arne Duncan and the reaction of educators to Arne Duncan's appointment. The idea that people with no educational experience, with business experience, can come in and dictate what our schools look like or should look like because they're terribly inefficient is the wrong narrative. We need someone who comes in and says, I want to privilege what happens to our children moving forward. And our litmus test shouldn't be how well our kids compete with the rest of the world on standardized tests. Our litmus test should be, what types of interventions can we foster, academic interventions, that allow our children to self-actualize, to be innovators, to continue those traditions of excellence that have helped to make America great and have led the world, not because we're able to compete with everyone on standardized tests, but have led the world because we're creative, critical thinkers who care about others and who aspire to lead from the standpoint of being servants. Again, some people see that as aspirational and have a problem with it, but in a lot of ways, if we look at the history of this nation, that is what's driven some of the greatest innovation.
Absolutely. We'll definitely want to have you back on, if you'd be willing to talk about these issues, and also particularly we want to get some of your thoughts about getting teachers and parents more involved in the role that you're playing in the BAT organization, the Badass Teachers Organization, which is probably becoming the most powerful voice in public education today. So we'll definitely see if we could schedule another interview. I wanted to close with one final thought, if you could pick any of these issues just to respond to, but when you Google Yuhuru Williams and you see all of the different commentary pieces that you write about, and of course the vast majority are about education and about your academic expertise in history, of which definitely people should read those because it's a real educational experience to read some of your academic work, but you also find things like The Day the Music Died and Limiting Freedom of Speech in Turkey. And I was wondering if you wanted just to talk a little bit about your activities beyond the education realm, because I found those as entertaining, as interesting as anything else you were writing.
You know what's interesting, John? I think we share this. And in fact, it's been a thrill to be on your program because I've been a huge fan of yours for some time. But I think at the end of the day, and I think this was evident in your run for the governorship, I think we both deeply care about democratic institutions and the importance of reminding people that all of us have a responsibility to be engaged wherever we see threats to the very foundations that have allowed this nation to, despite its foibles, overcome issues of economic diversity, overcome issues of racial discrimination. We have a long way to go. It's a great experiment, and it's not over yet, and people have to remain committed to that and all in terms of, as much as possible, making themselves available and to fight those issues and to bring up those issues and to make this a central part of their academic identity, in my case, their professional identity. These are the things that matter most. So most of what I write, most of what I do is driven by, again, my concern for those things. In Turkey, Erkem Demnali, who is the editor of Turkey's largest newspaper, was detained and accused of being a terrorist, basically for writing or printing articles that were critical of the government. That's a free speech issue. And that concerns me. I first became aware of it because he and others within Turkey were tweeting that using the I Can't Breathe hashtag that was related to the Eric Garner case in Staten Island, New York. And what they were saying essentially to African Americans and those concerned about police brutality here is that we see our situation in Turkey as intimately tied to what's happening in the United States. I believe that as an education activist, I have a responsibility then to respond to that, to be part of that energy, to study that issue and to see if there are connections there, and if they are there, to share them with people. Again, the same work that you've been doing with your blog, same things you've been doing with your career for your entire life. So I think that's really the nucleus of where a lot of that comes from. It's always thinking, you know, how do we make connections? How do we allow people to see the connectivity of our struggles? How do we really invest ourselves in the idea that in order to make our democracy better, in order to make this world better, we all have a responsibility to get in and stay in the fight?
Well, thank you again for coming on and for your profound thoughts and wisdom, guidance. We said it at the beginning, we'll say it at the end, and that is, if you haven't read Yehuru Williams's pieces, you need to do that. You need to make sure that you look for those, because you will find yourself better informed and better prepared to be part of the movement to take back the best parts of this country and to move us forward so that this country could actually become what it was meant to be. And so, Dr. Williams, thank you again for the time, and we look forward to talking with you again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks again, John.
You were just listening to an interview between Jonathan Pelto, who's a regular participant on this show, and Fairfield University professor Yehuru Williams. And speaking about democracy, Jonathan Pelto is here to tell us about what's going on in the state legislature and how it affects education. Jonathan, maybe you could fill us in on what the latest is there.
Well, this is what we call a long session in the Connecticut General Assembly, so it means that it's the session that the legislature will not only be adopting a two-year budget, but also any form of legislation can be submitted, and many, many different kinds of legislation has. So for those that are interested in public policy, this is exactly the time that they should pay attention. If they go to the General Assembly's website, they'll see a number of different tools that can be used to find out when bills are coming up for hearing, or what bills have been introduced, or what issues are being discussed throughout the session. The biggest issue, in many respects, will be the state budget. The state budget, we're facing a massive financial shortfall, and the governor has proposed a budget that makes record cuts to a wide variety of services, including record cuts to the public education and to higher education. Interestingly or unfortunately, he actually, at the same time of proposing record cuts to education, is proposing significantly more money for charter schools. So this effort behind the charter school industry to privatize public education is alive and well and gaining steam in a variety of places around the country, but especially New York and Connecticut are being targeted by the charter school industry with the hope that they can open up significantly more revenue for the charter school industry. But the budget goes well beyond that, although the governor said that if elected, he would not propose or accept any new taxes. There's almost $1 billion of new tax revenue in his budget. And that, even with $1 billion in new revenue, we still see these significant cuts. One of the places that is going to be most troublesome for cities and towns across Connecticut, that every town will be impacted by, is that the governor flat-funded what's called the educational cost-sharing formula. That's the money that goes to cities and towns to help them pay for education. This is actually the 9th year that the ECS formula has basically been flat-funded, which means more and more of the burden is being shifted from the state back to the local property taxpayers. Connecticut's Supreme Court had already ruled that our cost-sharing formula was unconstitutional because it didn't provide enough money to cities and towns to ensure that every child gets a quality education. But because of the budget shortfalls, what Governor Malloy did was he called for flat funding the ECS formula, but then went ahead and added to that problem nearly $70 million in cuts to a number of different education programs. So virtually every town in Connecticut, as they try to put their education budget together this year, their local education budget, will actually be trying to do that with less state aid than ever before, or less state aid than they've gotten in the last few years. And so it's going to mean a lot more program cuts at the local level. I think we'll see a large number of proposed layoffs of teachers and significant tax increases at the local level. So this is going to be an important session for people to voice their opinions if they're concerned about education, not only at the local level, but they need to be heard at the state level as the legislature thinks about whether or not it can move money around in order to provide more money for education, and also the very real issue that the governor has proposed of less money for public education but more money for charter schools, and whether if people don't want that to happen, then they need to make their views known to their legislators and do that quickly. The way that the budget process works is that the appropriations and finance committees do an analysis of the budget. They put an alternative budget together or make any changes to the budget. That usually is done by May 1st, and then by June 1st, the legislature has voted on a new two-year budget. So all of the decisions about which taxes will be increased, which programs will be cut, most of those decisions will be made between now and June 1st of this year.
Yeah, and Jonathan, first of all, so the state is mandating this new testing, and so that means more expenses for the schools, but then they're cutting funding, so they're not even supporting the schools in this transition to get this. Is that correct?
That's right. Yeah. I mean, you hear people talk about what's called an unfunded mandate, that is the federal government or the state government requiring governments to do something, but they're not providing the money for it. This is very much a classic example of that, but what's worse is the people that are being punished are not only the taxpayers, but the children. This is the first year that all children, all schools are supposed to give what's called the Smarter Balanced Assessment Consortium test, the SBAC Common Core test. It is a test that is designed to fail the majority of students. Anybody who has children, has had children, who went to school in Connecticut in the last two decades knows about something called the Connecticut Mastery Test. The Connecticut Mastery Test is given every year to determine how students are mastering the curriculum. There's a lot of controversy about mastery tests and that they discriminate against the poor, against people with English language issues who aren't fluent in the English language or who have special education needs. And so we know that the test is not a good way to really measure children. We're also the only industrialized country in the world that tests our children every year. Every other country knows that that's a waste of money and a waste of time. But Connecticut, like most states, have been doing it every year. It's been called the CMT. Now it's being moved to what's called the SBAC. This is the new Common Core test. What we're seeing all across the country is when they make this move from a mastery test to a Common Core test, what happens is it goes, because the Common Core test is the demarcation for that, the aim for that is about two grade levels above where children are, what you see is massive numbers of children being deemed failures. So under the Connecticut Mastery Test, about 70% of the kids successfully reach goal. The way that the SBAC Common Core Test is designed is that 70% of the kids will fail. And one of the concerns that a lot of us have is that you then start to tell children over and over again that they're failures, when in fact it's the test is rigged in such a way as to produce that failure. It's rigged that way because, A, it's content that they haven't been taught yet. It's content that's two grade levels above. And, B, the actual way that the scoring works is designed so that only 3 in 10 students reach the goal. As we've talked on this show before, it's all part of a broader effort to convince parents and taxpayers that public education is failing in the United States. And, of course, that's simply not true. But if it's perceived to be failing, then what the corporate education reform industry hopes is that more and more policymakers will agree to turning our schools over to private corporations, because what they will say is, look, the public schools aren't working, therefore let's hire private companies to do that, whether they're charter schools or other kinds of private enterprise to run public education. the foothold, the linchpin of the entire system is this Common Core testing. And so a number of us are working very hard to tell parents that they do have the right to opt their children out, and in fact, we recommend that they opt their children out for any number of reasons, not the least of which is that we think it's very detrimental to children to be told their failures. It's very detrimental to the local public school system and the teachers, because under Connecticut law, under the law that Governor Malloy pushed through, teachers will actually be evaluated on those faulty test scores. So teachers that are perfectly good, great teachers, will now be dragged down because the test scores will be lower, and the test scores will be lower because they're intentionally rigged to produce lower. So parents have the fundamental right. There is no state law, federal law, policy, regulation that allows government or local school districts to punish children or their parents for opting their children out. But unfortunately, the school districts have been told by the Malloy administration that there is no opt-out provision. It's not a question of whether there's an opt-out provision in the statute. What the issue is that there is no law or mechanism for the government to punish children or their parents. And so we're seeing increasing numbers of people opting their children out, and hopefully that will send a powerful message to legislators that it's really unacceptable. Not only is it just a huge waste of money, and not only is that cost being borne primarily by local property taxpayers, but it's a huge waste of time. There are school districts in Connecticut that are really being shifted over to little more than standardized testing factories. The estimate is that as much as 20% of the instructional time is now being lost to testing. So if you imagine basically one out of every 5 days of school is either testing or prepping for the testing, that we're going to lose tremendous amounts of instructional time. Children who have any form of challenges, whether it's special ed challenges, language challenges, behavioral challenges, those kids are going to become more and more difficult because they're going to be spending all of their time testing instead of learning. And then the long-term devastating effects of telling kids as early as kindergarten that they're failures and then telling them they're failures every year.
Also, I think all this data that's collected on these tests on each child is saved by the state and the federal government. And who knows, for the rest of this child's life, this data is there, and who knows what they'll do with that.
That's
and
right.
How that could impact them with jobs, and et cetera. So I think that parents really need to think about that, all that data that's being collected on a test that's not fair. And I just saw on your blog test results where they compared the CMT and CAPT scores from the last year that they did the testing to last year's testing on the SBAC in Connecticut. And I guess that was leaked. It wasn't supposed to be released, but you have it. And maybe you could talk about that and then tell people how they could see that on your website.
That's right. So we've been asking the state of Connecticut to release the information. Last year, most towns did try to force their children into taking what was at that point the test of a test. It was the SBAC field test. This year is the SBAC real test. Interestingly, the state of Connecticut says it has no data. It has no data to turn over, despite the Freedom of Information Act saying that they have to turn it over. Well, we got a copy. In fact, it's hidden on the SBAC website, the national website, which is the data from the test. And what it shows is exactly what we've been saying all along, that in Connecticut, it looks like we're 70% of the children were mastering it and always have. And we're now looking at something closer to 30%. And even more devastating will be the discrimination against children needing English language help or special education help, Latinos, African-American children who were and are meeting the curriculum goals. But the way that this test is designed, we will see them now at 80% of them failing, 90% of them failing. In one of the special ed categories, more than 90% of the children were deemed failures, when in fact, that's just not the case. And so the state of Connecticut is really stonewalling people from knowing the truth. And if you go to my website, jonathanpelto.com, and type in SBAC or Common Core test, you'll not only see the data, you'll also find letters that you can use to opt your children out of the Common Core testing. The Common Core testing window runs from March through June, and they will be put hours and hours and hours and hours of testing. And what superintendents have to allow parents to opt their children out, they are begrudgingly allowing that to happen. And what we're recommending is that not only do you demand that your child be opted out, but that they be given appropriate instructional activities during that time so that they're not just sitting there staring at the computer. And in fact, the majority of towns, although they are trying still to get parents not to opt their children out, the towns that we're hearing about is in the end, they are providing those children with alternative learning opportunities, which is good for those children, and hopefully more parents will take advantage of that.
Yeah, and there's a website, unitedoptout.com, where the parents can go and find forms for each state that you can fill out to opt your child out. They have it all done to help you, so please check that out, unitedoptout.com. And they have a lot of other information and resources on that site, so I highly recommend it. And also, as Jonathan mentioned, you can also find the forms on his website, jonathanpelto.com. And Jonathan, I was following the data on the ESL students from that article that you sent out on that, comparing the CMT with the new SBAC for last year. And, you know, it's shocking. I was noticing as they went up the grade levels, the ESL students did a lot worse because the language gets more complex. And they may know these skills in their first language, but they just don't know the English language to be able to read the questions or take the test, really. And so they're really being punished. It's not an accurate representation of what they know. And I think that's criminal. And it seems like it would be a much fairer system if they were given at least 3 years to develop their English language skills before forcing them to take tests that could heavily impact their futures and, of course, their teachers' evaluations, which are partially dependent on their test scores. Now, Jonathan, in the federal government now, the No Child Left Behind bill is up for reauthorization, and actually the vote this week on it. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. As difficult and as ugly a picture as it is here in Connecticut and the need for people to speak out and to speak up about the privatization of public education and about turning us into little more than testing factories around the Common Core testing, is that the root of all of those problems go back to the No Child Left Behind legislation and the race to the top. People are starting to know a little bit more about this, but No Child Left Behind was a creature created by George W. Bush, and Race to the Top was an expansion of that under Barack Obama. So the attack on public education has been bipartisan, Republicans and Democrats equally bad when it comes to promoting public education. The underlying foundation of all of this is called the No Child Left Behind Act, and that is what's called up for reauthorization. That is, that these bills, they sunset, they end, unless they're reauthorized. And it's time for the reauthorization of No Child Left Behind. So that will be done by Congress, by the United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives. The first vote is coming up this week. There was a lot of hope that they would reduce the mandate on annual testing. There was a lot of hope that they would give states more leeway. There was a lot of hope that they would recognize the right of parents. And few of those things have happened so far. So although the Republicans are fighting with Obama and Obama and the Democrats are fighting with Republicans on every other issue, unfortunately, when it comes to this corporate education reform effort, they join forces. And so legislators will be voting within the next few days and then the final action taken probably within the next month, whether or not to change No Child Left Behind so that we can actually make the changes that are needed at the state level.
Yeah, and I know one of the parts of No Child Left Behind that when I was actually in education, everyone in education thought was absurd, but we had to do and follow, was that by 2014, all children were supposed to be 100% proficient on the math and reading tests on CAPT and CMT, and now it would be the SBAC. What's happening with that? Are they still pursuing that?
They have removed that particular portion. It's almost as if they've done the one thing that could possibly be worse, and that is they've removed the goals of success, but they've put in all of the testing, all of the mandates, all of the privatization, so that now they don't have to be held accountable for whether or not it works. They just get to keep on testing our children and privatizing our schools. And what is so frustrating for people that support public education is that people who talk about respecting local control and respecting parental rights on both sides of the political aisle end up then supporting this corporate education reform effort. That when you step back and you look at it, it takes away democracy. It has, as we have talked about, it takes away any chance for parents to be heard and takes the country in exactly the wrong direction. And so one would think and hope that the federal government would be more sensitive to providing for flexibility. But in fact, what we're seeing is both the Democrats and the Republicans doing exactly the opposite, and that is taking away local control, taking away flexibility, taking away parental rights, taking away the notion that all children learn, they just learn at different paces and in different ways. And they keep on wanting to go with this very cookie-cutter approach where every state and every school has to approach things the same way. Not only is that absurd, not only is that not the way to educate children, but it really is un-American, anti-American, at least to the basic ideals that we're supposed to stand for. And that's why this reauthorization of the No Child Left Behind becomes so important, because if they do it, we will be stuck with this system for another 10 years.
Yeah, and that would be really devastating. Jonathan, is there anything we haven't talked about today that you'd like to share with the listeners?
Well, if there are organizations or groups out there that would like to know more, there are a number of people here in Connecticut that are very willing to come out and speak to those groups. And they could reach any of us. Probably the easiest way is through my website, jonathanpelto.com. And there's a contact button. And if you contact us and you have an organization that would like to hear more about the Common Core testing, or any of these other issues, we'd be happy to try to find a spokesperson to come out and tell you a little bit about what's going on.
Right. And I want to recommend Jonathan himself is very knowledgeable on this and would be a great person to do that. But we can also probably arrange to have most of the speakers that you've heard on these shows over the last year to come and speak, or others locally. So please let us know and get in touch with us. And time is not on our side, so don't wait on that. Well, Jonathan, thanks again for being on the show.
And thank you for doing this show. I'm hearing more and more people saying that they're starting to hear about these issues. And some of these smaller town superintendents are telling me that the number of people, for example, that are opting out are double and triple what happened last year. So I do think that people are starting to learn. And I thank you for providing this platform for people to hear about these important things that are going on with their children in their local schools.
You know, having been an educator for most of my life, I've seen the impact of this privatization effort from the inside, and it's so disturbing and such a threat to our democracy that I felt that I had to do something. And this show is what I can best contribute. And thank you for your kind words. And I want to remind the listeners that the Assault on Public Education airs on the last Monday of every month from noon to 1 p.m. and is archived at the station, wwuh.org, for 2 weeks after airing. And it's permanently archived at the website radioforall.net. And once you get on the site, if you, in the search box, put in the Assault on Public Education, all the shows will pop up. And if you're new to this corporate and government-driven effort to privatize our public schools, if you take the time to listen to the first three shows, you'll have a good idea of what's going on. And again, the website there would be radioforall.net. And that's the digit for radioforall.net. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is.
By the media.